Across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 2, 2003. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The nation's largest food manufacturer, Kraft, announces it will produce smaller portions to help the nation's obesity problem. And as Australia prepares to send troops to the Solomon Islands, they say in a peacekeeping effort, citizens of both countries question the real motives. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United States has declared nearly 50 nations, including Colombia, ineligible for military aid because they back the International Criminal Court. Sputnik Colombia reports.
Some $48 million in aid will be blocked to countries that have not signed exemption agreements, including Colombia, one of the largest recipients of U.S. military aid. Other major countries liable to the suspension of military aid are Brazil, Cambodia, Serbia, and South Africa. Some analysts say blocking such aid jeopardizes both U.S. security and business interests. The issue has also triggered a row with the European Union, which firmly backs the International Criminal Court. This has left many Balkan countries which wish to join the European Union caught in the crossfire. Serbia, which is under constant pressure to extradite war criminals to the Hague Tribunal, has complained of double standards. Albania and Bosnia are among 44 countries that have publicly acknowledged signing exemption deals with the U.S. Washington's fears that the ICC would be used for politically motivated prosecution of U.S. personnel have been dismissed by human rights groups who say the court has enough safeguards in place. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S. campaign has not undermined support for the court, but has instead damaged Washington's image abroad. Sputnik Kilambi in Pristina reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush has named an ex-drug company executive to run the AIDS Fund. Pamela Barnett is in Washington, D.C.
President Bush's decision to tap Randall Tobias, a former chief executive for pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly, to administer the U.S.'s $15 billion African AIDS Fund is being met with concern among some global AIDS activists. Eli Lilly contributed nearly $650,000 to the GOP in the last election cycle, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Bernard Rivers, executive director of AIDSpan.
He is a former CEO of a major pharmaceutical company, and if he primarily pursues the interests of his former company and his former industrial sector, then that will be deeply disappointing and to be condemned.
David Bryden of the Global AIDS Alliance said Tobias's appointment represents a potential conflict of interest, and wondered whether Tobias would fight for the distribution of low-cost generic anti-AIDS drugs. Pamela Barnett reporting in D.C. for Free Speech Radio News.
The Pentagon is developing surveillance software capable of tracking, recording, and analyzing the movements of vehicles and of identifying the faces of the driver and passengers. Renee Gorman reports.
The project, named Combat Zones at Sea, will identify vehicles by their size, color, shape, and license plate number. The software will analyze the recordings and identify supposed suspicious behavior. This new technology will be used in select foreign cities to protect American troops and to assist with fighting. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the division of the Department of Defense conducting the research, has civil libertarians worried the software will eventually expand to local law enforcement agencies. Jay Stanley, communication director of the Technological and Liberty Program at the ACLU, believes this is part of a worrying trend in Pentagon research.
The Pentagon is increasingly devoting itself to defense research projects which can be turned inward on the American people, and I think this is an example of that.
DARPA says the new software is not intended for homeland security purposes and would have to be drastically modified in order to serve any other purpose than that intended. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, this is Renee Gorman.
In New Jersey, the General Assembly approved a measure today to eliminate the post of State Poet Laureate. Simba Rousseau files this report.
In a 69-2 vote, New Jersey state lawmakers voted yesterday to eliminate the position of Poet Laureate, an effort that began last fall after Amir Baraka's controversial poem, Somebody Blew Up America, gained national attention. A poem, the lawmakers say, suggested that Israel had advanced knowledge of the September 11th terrorist attacks. Poet Laureate Amir Baraka.
Why was five Israelis filming the explosion and cracking their sides at the notion? That's not something I made up. That was in the Star Ledger. Another article in the New York Times. 5, passport-holding Israeli citizens filming the explosion on top of a truck on the New Jersey side, filming the World Trade Center that exploded. The state police arrested them. Several weeks later, they were deported. The system that committed the terror on black people have committed the same kind of terrorist acts against everybody in the world.
The $10,000 annual stipend that goes to the Port Laureate was suspended after Baraka refused to resign. Governor James McGreevy intends to sign the bill, removing the poet from his post. After yesterday's vote, Baraka said he would sue the state for violating his First Amendment rights. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Simba Russo.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, today the Israeli military withdrew tanks and armored personnel carriers from the streets of Bethlehem and handed over law enforcement duties to the Palestinian Authority. This comes after a Tuesday evening meeting in Jerusalem between Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, during which Abbas called for the release of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli detention. The Palestinian Prime Minister also asked for lifting of the military-imposed 24-hour curfew on the occupied West Bank towns and villages. Coordinator of the Rapprochement Center in Beit Sahor, Bethlehem, George Rishmawi, says Palestinians remain wary of the Israeli troop withdrawal.
What we have seen on the ground is an unseen withdrawal of the Israeli army that happened, I think, last night. And a new deployment of the Palestinian police in Bethlehem region. However, so far, the roadblocks that are blocking Bethlehem area and the checkpoints and the siege is still imposed on the area, and people are still unable to go in or out of Bethlehem area except if they have passing permits, which is a new policy that Israel implemented since a few months, that they impose that people have to have permits to go from one zone A to another zone A in the West Bank.
We saw Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas meeting yesterday with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Is Mahmoud Abbas endorsed by the Palestinian people for this move, this handover of power to the Palestinian Authority?
Any decisions that will come up, if not accepted by the people or coordinated with the different political factions in Palestine, including the PLO members and the non-PLO members like Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, if these decisions are not accepted and endorsed by those people, those communities, those factions, I don't think they have a chance to be implemented, or they don't have a chance to last for a long time. Now they're talking about the truce, about a conditional truce, 3-month truce, and this truce is a very fragile truce that can be broken easily by one person shooting at a settler's car or at an army jeep or whatever. And then they can blow everything up. Now, Israel says that we are not part of this truce because this has been an agreement between Palestinian political parties, between the PA and terrorist organizations. The United States says that if the PA doesn't dismantle the infrastructure of terrorism in Palestine, meaning Hamas and Islamic Jihad in their definition, so then this truce is not enough, even if they have committed to stopping the attacks against Israel, and it's not enough, so there should be more things. Basically, they are calling for a civil war in Palestine, so that it will be accepted. And this is the only way that they can keep control over the Palestinian people here.
Just one final question. Do you think the Palestinian people actually want the factions like Hamas and Islamic Jihad to be dismantled?
The Palestinian people want to see something practical is happening. They want to see that they can go every day to the different areas that they want to go to their work. They want to go to Jerusalem, they want to go from Bethlehem to Ramallah, to Nablus, to Jenin, without having to go, 4 or 5 hours instead of 2, and change 4 or 5 transportation instead of 1 or 2, and walk in the fields instead of driving on paved roads. Now, dismantling Hamas is is not going to help. But with people are not supporting actually what Hamas is doing in principle, because when Hamas convinces people that this is the only way, when Israel all the time, you know, arrests and demolish houses and assassinate people, then they say we shouldn't stand still, we shouldn't just, you know, watch what they are doing, we should do something.
George Rishmawi, coordinator of the Rapprochement Center in Beit Sahor, Bethlehem. The nation's largest food manufacturer, Kraft Foods, has promised to take steps to help reduce the obesity epidemic in the United States, modifying its marketing practices and making its portions smaller. Meanwhile, Kraft's parent company, Altria, continues to market the world's most popular cigarette brands. Josh Chaffin reports.
Kraft says it will take steps to improve the nutritional value of its products, that it'll provide additional nutrition labeling, and that it'll stop marketing to kids while they're in school. That's music to the ears of a San Francisco attorney named Stephen Joseph.
I think it's a huge event and a great thing for public health in this country.
Joseph made the papers back in May when he took Kraft to court over their Oreo cookies. The suit complained the public was not informed that the cookies contain trans fats, which studies show are a significant contributor to heart disease. He has since pulled his suit, citing concessions from Kraft.
I think they realize that they have a liability issue, which they want to avoid. But I also think that perhaps some people at Kraft realize that they have a responsibility too, a moral responsibility, because there is an obesity epidemic and there is a related type 2 diabetes epidemic among children in particular. And they have a very big part to play in resolving that problem.
The Food and Drug Administration says about 60% of Americans are overweight, and big food companies are bracing for a wave of class action lawsuits like the ones that have cost big tobacco billions of dollars in recent years. Obese people are starting to sue companies like McDonald's and Burger King and KFC, claiming they weren't warned of the high salt and fat content.
A 10-piece bucket of hot and fresh chicken, 3 large homestyle sides, and 6 biscuits.
Results have been mixed so far, but the Frito-Lay company announced last year it would eliminate trans fats from its Doritos chips, and McDonald's said it would start making its French fries with less trans fat. Kraft said this week it would start advocating for better eating and more active lifestyles, but while the company says it'll stop marketing in schools, Gary Ruskin notices Kraft has not pledged to stop marketing to children altogether. Ruskin is co-founder of Commercial Alert in Portland, Oregon, which is right now trying to get the National Parent Teacher Association to break its sponsorship agreement with Coca-Cola.
It's important to remember that Kraft is part of the Altria family of companies. As such, it is tightly tied to Philip Morris and the Merchants of Death, and we ought to take with a grain of salt what the Merchants of Death say to us.
Altria makes Marlboro, Virginia Slims, Benson & Hedges, Merit, and Parliament cigarettes. In addition to Kraft, Altria controls Maxwell House, Nabisco, Oscar Mayer, Tang, Miller Beer, Kool-Aid, the vegetarian Boca Burger, Velveeta, Grape Nuts, and Altoids Breath Mints, among others. To the Cool
Whip. Now in red, white, and blue decorative tubs. Cool
Whip. America's berry trees. Cool Whip. Cool Whip's all you need.
Consumers could be about to lose a lot of their leverage against these food manufacturing giants. Republicans are pushing to move virtually all national class action lawsuits from state court into federal court, where they're known to be less likely to succeed. According to the nonpartisan group the Center for Responsive Politics, the tobacco and food product sectors combined have given more than $75 million to national political campaigns since 1990, three-quarters of it to Republicans, against Stephen Joseph, the attorney who brought the Oreo case.
Let's face it. I mean, corporations control Capitol Hill through campaign contributions and general lobbying efforts. The people don't control Capitol Hill. So when Congress is saying that it's going to push tort reform and try and prevent these lawsuits, then I'm very suspicious. If Congress can't be trusted to get the nation's food supply under control, then why should they stop attorneys from trying to do that?
The class action reform bill has passed the House, and it could come up in the Senate this September. Kraft's announcement that it will start disclosing trans fat content comes as the FDA this week said all food companies will soon be required to do so. The company did not respond to requests for comment by airtime. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News.
Australian Prime Minister John Howard announced the country's National Security Committee had decided to send some 1,200 troops, 200 of them combat soldiers, and 300 Australian Federal Police officers to the Solomon Islands for at least 3 months. It'll be the largest Australian armed intervention in the South Pacific since World War II. Since 1998, there's been often violent civil conflict in the Solomon Islands, yet this conflict is, in large part, due to a big rise of youth unemployment resulting from cuts in public spending implemented by the government at the behest of the IMF in the wake of the 1997-98 Asian financial crisis. And as Guy Deegan reports from Sydney, Australia, while South Pacific neighbours have backed Australian intervention, critics question whether sending troops will actually help the people of the so-called Happy Isles.
International observers see the Solomon's intervention as a stark change in Australia's engagement with the Pacific. Whether asserting itself as a Pacific power transpires into Australia seeking opportunities in the region remains to be seen. An Australian government-linked think tank argues that a failing Solomon Islands is depriving Australia of business and investment opportunities. However, before any deployment of police and troops, the Solomon Islands needs to pass legislation to establish the legal framework for the multinational force. Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer.
We hope that the appropriate legislation to provide legal cover for the intervention will pass through the Parliament fairly quickly. I made the point at the meeting today that, in the end, all those who are in Solomon Islands have to operate under Solomon Islands law.
Though the so-called cooperative intervention in the Solomons has the universal support of the Pacific Islands Forum, will the intervention force help the people of the Solomons in the long term? Tim O'Connor from the independent Australian aid monitoring group AidWatch says no.
We would see it that it was just a band-aid measure, really. The cause of the problem in the Solomons has been created by situations where aid is being delivered to a small number of elites in those countries, and they are reaping the benefits. And this creates a dual economy, where the formal economy, the ones that get access to the aid and the associated benefits, are becoming directly opposed to the informal economy, the people that don't get access to this aid. And this creates a tension, and the effects of that we're seeing in a situation that's developed there now.
Echoing the concerns of AidWatch is Iggy Kim, Campaign Coordinator for Action in Solidarity for the Asia-Pacific, ASAP. Kim argues that since the 97 Asia-Pacific financial crisis, Australia has placed economic pressure on the Solomons to cut back on social expenditure and has reduced aid funding.
A lot of the sort of fundamental infrastructural problems are being caused that lie behind these present ethnic tensions and the crisis. This has been brought on the Solomons by big, powerful neighbours like Australia, and our concern is that Australian military intervention or policing intervention in the Solomons will only be very counterproductive. In fact, it will, in the long range, potentially fuel more ethnic tensions and make things worse.
How the intervention force deals with the ethnic tensions throughout the archipelago is another major issue. Tim O'Connor from AidWatch says the Australian government doesn't know what it's getting itself into.
This is a real legacy of colonialism. The Solomon Islands is made up of a significant number of very different cultural groups, and they all have different needs and wants, and the way that the aid program works is they place a template where it's sort of one size fits all.
Iggy Kim shares those concerns and believes the Australian government will find itself working against the best interests of all Solomon Islanders.
The Australian government will, you know, have to take sides between the competing ethnic groups, and the current ruling this sort of elite stratum of Malaitan people that have invited Australian forces in, they will continue to gain elite benefits from Australia's intervention, and will not deliver benefits to all the Solomons people, both Guadalcanalan and the Malaitan people.
Australia's decision to come to the aid of a so-called failing state also poses the question, are Australian interests being served in helping the Solomons? The Howard government says there's a need to maintain a secure and stable region, but Iggy Kim thinks there's more at stake.
The most clear one is the Goldridge gold mine, which is a very large operation in the Solomons, and it's owned by Australian interests, so that's its most salient economic interests that are there. But also, the Solomons imports a hell of a lot of goods from Australia. A huge percentage of Solomon's imports in processed food and other commodity products come from Australia. So it's a market that needs to be protected, sure.
The Solomon Islands Parliament will sit next week to prepare the legal framework for the intervention force, which could be deployed by the end of July. Defence analysts in Australia caution that casualties are possible and restoring the rule of law could take years. In Sydney, Australia, and for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Guy Deegan.
Federal officials are finding manufacturing sites for weapons of mass destruction in the American South and Southwest. Department of Energy managers are planning to build a new plant for the mass production of plutonium pits, the triggers at the core of nuclear bombs. They've been looking at five sites in Texas, Nevada, South Carolina, and two in New Mexico, where Joe Gardner-Wesley reports on the controversy.
My name is Arminia Juarez. I'm 20, and I'm against it, against the pits.
My name is Crystal Trujillo. I'm 19, and I'm against the pits.
All right.
My name is Miguel Moreno, and I'm 18, I'm against the pits.
Members of the youth group Product of Aztlan joined dozens of other speakers last night in the Pueblo town of Powake to oppose a planned facility for plutonium pits. Many of the speakers live near Los Alamos, where the national labs have resumed small-scale pit production. But the Department of Energy's National Nuclear Security Administration, or NNSA, claims it needs a new plant to produce hundreds of pits per year in order to keep the U.S. nuclear stockpile functional. Jay Rose of the NNSA.
We've made great strides in reducing the nuclear weapons stockpile in the last 35 years. The Non-Proliferation Treaty does not set forth a specific time for meeting the ultimate goal of nuclear disarmament. Meantime, while we have a nuclear stockpile, which the President and the Congress direct us to maintain, keeping that stockpile safe, reliable, operational is not a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Rose and his colleagues were in the Santa Fe, Los Alamos area last night to take public comments on the draft environmental impact statement for the pit facility. They received jeers and heckling as an overflow crowd unanimously opposed the so-called modern pit facility. Miles Nelson of the nuclear watchdog group Citizen Action.
A modern pit facility that manufactures 125 pits a year with a lifetime of 60 years is enough to maintain an arsenal of 7,500 weapons. Why do we need to maintain so many weapons when we're committed to reduce our nuclear arsenal?
Activists like Nelson characterize the facility as a factory for new nuclear bombs, while DOE officials stress that it is for maintenance of the nuclear stockpile. One of the graphs in the environmental impact statement drew the eye of Dr. Arjun Makhajani, president of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. It stated there would be 0.22 cancer fatalities per year.
0.22 cancer fatalities per year means one every 4.5 years. It doesn't mean that after 4.5 years somebody will die. It means that there will have been enough radiation doses that over a long period of time, you know, with cancer latency periods, that the cancer may not develop for 10 or 20 years.
NNSA officials dispute Dr. Makhajani's interpretation of their documents. Jerry Friedman is director of the Pitt Project Office at the DOE.
The assertion is that you would have one worker who could work 4,900 years, as Jay Rose said in his talk, to get a dose that would produce one fatality. But you're not going to have one worker working 4,900 years. You're going to have 1,100 workers working at an exposure level, which we state in there, which is 510 millirem per year, which is a factor of, you know, instead of 5,000, which is a legal limit, it's a fraction of that.
And I say we say, no nuclear bomb factory, nowhere, no way.
While opposition near Santa Fe was overwhelming, it was reportedly in the minority in Carlsbad, New Mexico, the night before. One reason that community may be more eager to host the facility is that the economy there is not as strong. Public hearings on the modern pit facility are being held in Las Vegas, Nevada tonight, and will go to Augusta, South Carolina on Saturday. On July 16th, there will be a hearing in Washington, D.C., and the DOE will accept written comments until August 5th. For instructions on how to submit comments, you can go to www.nukewatch.org. In Powake, New Mexico, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley for Free Speech Radio News.
The Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 2000 is giving the recording industry and its advocates, namely the Recording Industry Association of America, or the RIAA, the ability to search the internet addresses of all those downloading information suspected to be copyrighted music. Last week, the RIAA said it would begin searching internet file sharing networks for music fans with, quote, substantial MP3 song files. But critics of the RIAA downloader crackdown claim the recording industry and the RIAA are manipulating how copyright laws are interpreted, with potentially damaging effects on consumer rights and artistic creativity. From WBAI, Brendan Sweeney and Jackson Allers have this report.
The Recording Industry Association of America, or the RIAA, the Washington, D.C.-based lobbying group that represents the major record labels like Columbia and Universal, stated last week that in the next 2 months, several hundred lawsuits will be brought against individual computer users who they say are downloading free music illegally on the Internet. Amy Weiss, Vice President of Communications for the RIAA.
When we made the hard decision that we needed to sue individuals to send a strong deterrent message that what people are doing is in fact illegal and we will protect our rights and the rights of the songwriters and artists and others, we knew we wouldn't win a popularity contest, but we're not doing this to be popular. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do.
According to the RIAA, the record industry has been hit hard by the current recession. Record sales over the last 3 years are down 23%, contrary to what the RIAA says are the historical trends, which indicate sales stay constant in times of economic hardship. In 2002, the record industry made $12.6 billion, about a $1 billion drop from 2001. But what the RIAA and the record industry call the right thing to do is questionable on a number of levels, according to critics. Ilan Oren, CEO of iMesh.com, an Israel-based file-sharing company, says the record industry and the RIAA are pursuing a path that represents both poor business practice and a disregard for its fan base. Oren says he has tried for 3 years to comply with RIAA music file-sharing guidelines with little or no response.
I never heard of a business in the United States came out and said to its potential customers, we're going to come and sue you and we're not going to make our stuff available to you on the systems that you use.
DJ ESE is a small record label owner and hip-hop instrumentalist out of Brooklyn, New York. Based on his experience with his label Embedded Records and his position as product manager for another independent hip-hop label, Definitive Jux Records, DJ ESE says the record labels and the RIAA are fighting the downloading battle on ideological terms rather than practical economic terms.
What I think the RIAA is doing is they're going to spend just as much money between now and when they can create a new digital format that they can monopolize trying to stop digital download because they have that much money.
Cultural critics worry that the terms of this debate mark a fundamental shift in understanding the uses and definitions of copyright law.
The purpose of copyright is to disseminate information, to disseminate culture.
Kimberly McLeod, a communications professor at the University of Iowa, has written extensively on what he says is the record industry's attempt at undermining the historical interpretation and value of copyright laws.
No copyright holder has the power to have complete control over their copyrighted good. Yes, copyright does provide temporary legal protection, but there has to be a little push and pull. Book publishers went after public libraries saying that if anyone can check out a single copy of a book and multiple people can do this, it's going to put the publishing industry under. And that didn't happen, of course.
Meanwhile, the Record Industry Association of America has not made clear the criterion for how many songs downloaded to a user's computer merit a lawsuit. With thanks to Brendan Sweeney from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City, I'm Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.